518 Valencia Street in San Francisco, near the 16th and Mission BART. Author Carolina de Robertis calls Kate's book a powerful, boldly imagined, and brilliantly executed portrait of Palestine and Israel that's also a wicked pleasure to read. This event benefits the Middle East Children's Alliance and is wheelchair accessible. For info, meccaforpeace.org, 510-548-0542.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. This first Thursday in September is the 22nd anniversary of the Visionary Activist Show. Woohoo! And how perfect our guest, whom I will bring in moments after weaving a smidge of context, Mercury, our power of intellect and discernment, is stationing now, exactly trining Uranus, called the higher octave of Mercury, the trickster. So, how wonderful. Throughout the 22 years, we go, we don't really want to have an impact, you know, impact a short, violent encounter. You know, as David Grimes suggested, just the cunning use of hyphens, just put a hyphen in impact. We want an impact, an influential impact. There we go. And everything's speaking to us. I love a friend who's autocorrect changed hallucinogenic into hallucinogen, and we go, that's wonderful. So our wonderful guest, Tony Vigorito, part two, I'm searching my archives, we had our first contact April 30th, 2010, when I wrote to him through his website, tonyvigorito.com, and I said, found your tone resonant and fun, re-human abdication of responsibility via spiritual colonialism, 2012 fetishism. You know, might you send me your favorite novel for deep delving perusal, and maybe we could do some radio. So we did Nine Kinds of Naked, a wonderful novel first, and then March 17th, March 16th, we hosted Tony with his splendid, splendid book, Love and Other Pranks, but I hadn't finished the last 100 pages, which is kind of crucial, and I was off to Egypt, leaving the book behind. Then I ran into him at the glorious Eclipse Festival ordeal at the Phoenix Rising booth, right? And I finagled a copy of this book, Love and Other Pranks, and gave it to my beloved brother Joe, whose birthday was August 21st, the eclipse, who said that it was better than the eclipse itself. He sat down and in his tent in the festival and read the entire thing in one sitting, and he is a man of great and high discernment. So that's great. So our show today, Trickster, liberates us from the bamboozling con. We welcome liberating satiric genius Tony Vigorito, author of Cannot Recommend Highly Enough, the spicy, jaunty, liberating, highly pertinent trickster novel Love and Other Pranks, and we explore our shared dedication that trickster be liberating us from the con. And Tom Robbins wrote about this book, maybe the single wildest novel I've ever read. It rings the cosmic gong on so many levels, turns so many stereotypes inside out. One scarcely knows what to do but hold on and enjoy the ride, and enjoy it I did. So welcome, Tony.
Hi, Caroline. So nice to speak with you again.
Ah, that's great. Okay, and we will prevail on Mercury to make our phone lines even clearer. That's great. So I'm so delighted because it seems, you know, again, our shared dedication and what is so wonderfully animated in your novel of discerning the, you know, the con from the liberating trick is so pertinent now as massive delusion kind of wafts through the internet, and we go, that's really great. But So we did briefly coincide at the Eclipse Festival, and then you were then went home, I guess, for a brief change of underwear, and went off to the Burning Man, right?
Yeah, that was not the plan, but that is that is how the fortune cookie crumbled for our path. I don't know that I would do that again. You know, two sort of very intense events back to back like that. Yeah, it was a grand time while it lasted.
Yeah. And I think we want to weave everything together because you have such a discerning eye, and you know all of these ways we gather. There's everything kind of interwoven. There's the con and the liberating trick, and festival culture is an intriguing conundrum. There are always some elements of ordeal, and then it is also just a wonderful place to connect, and you know the renaissance of creative thinkers and people. So how was your Burning Man? We know there was some tragedy there.
Burning Man was Burning Man, you know. I mean, you know, it starts out just, you know, fresh and fantastic. As you said, it's, I think the most wonderful aspect of it is just the opportunity to just sort of wander about and run into absolutely random strangers and then have, you know, just drop in and have great conversations or crack each other up, as the case may be. And, so I had just a wonderful time early in the week. I actually brought 100 copies of my book as gifts, and so whoever I, you know, had anything more than a mundane encounter with, I would offer them a book, and it was just fun to be able to engage with people at that level. As the week wore on, I did not end up feeling well health-wise, and so we ended up leaving before the before the man burned itself. It was no regrets, and it was a wonderful time as always.
Well, that's intriguing. I am still recovering from my eclipse cold, followed by airplane flight, which forced all the dust and exciting viruses and bacteria deeper into the body. And I know a number of people who have this cold. Hello, fellow cold, you know, hosts. So there is that. But my enthusiasm also for cahooting with you, and I do love that, you know, when we met at the Phoenix Rising booth and you recognized my voice and then you were leaving them a copy of your book, and we cahooted and then I went away, and then I was like, no, I must get that book for my brother. So I went back and finagled their copy, and they said they could get another one from you. I hope they did, right? But
the next time I was there, they told me about that, and I was sure to get them two extra copies of the book in case you came back and needed another one.
I do. I need at least 5 to 10 more copies because I find it's so. And now that I've read the final 100 pages, and I'm really glad I waited because it does, you know, culminate in the eclipse in the fabulous multiple stories interweaving. But I thought, you know, now is so important, you know, when we read out there in the internet. And, you know, it reminds me of Eric Davis, whom I hope to host again as well, a really smart kind of science wizard. And he gave a really great talk at the Hub Stage, where I was emceeing with Emma Kayla. And he, in a very deft and jaunty fashion, the likes of your own narrative tone, he went into bringing discernment into conspiracy theories. And he did a wonderful thing that I cannot do full justice to, but he said, you know, the burgeoning of the Renaissance of the 60s, which was great, and the kind of disruptive creative suspicion and rejection of orthodoxy, yes, but it became reactive, and the dismissal of, you know, all science as part of a trick of the reality police and all news organizations is what, and he tracked it very well as to why this gave rise to Trump and the mania of right-wing conspiracy theories, the dismissal of everything, even the authentic, hardworking investigative journalist as just fake news. And it's like, it's this climate. So I thought that we might put some guidelines of trickster discerning, you know, before our team, just to clarify. And I was just addressing in my own trickster council, somebody had posted something from, you know, a well-meaning con, I'm going to say, just for the fun of it, but who was talking about the hurricanes as, of course, they're geoengineered by this cabal of evil people. I'm like, no, this is an abdication of collective human responsibility. There is such a thing as geoengineering, but this is, you know, anyway, and part for me, and let me toss it back to you, the person was talking about, you know, we are the ascended people. I'm like, uh-oh, I'm very down on ascension. And you have the holy order of beautiful people, right, in your novel, The Chosen People. So we have the eclipse cauldron. Might we throw the con of chosen people into the cauldron?
Oh, sure. And I missed, unfortunately, I missed Eric Davis's talk, but that theme is one that I came across a few weeks ago, I believe, in an article in The Atlantic. Another writer was making that very same connection between the sort of the sort of visionary postmodernism that came out of 1960s counterculture, right, and where reality is completely up for grabs, right? And while there's, like, obviously the tremendous creative ferment and even an element of truth to that, it's hard to deny then that there's a shadow, there's a dark side to that we're seeing manifest in current politics today, right? So as I've been watching all of this sort of unfold, it's astonishing. I mean, as both a social psychologist and as a novelist, right, I'm just watching the way that reality is attempting to be inscribed, you know, by competing parties, right? It's quite something to watch, and more than a little unsettling. As to the second part of your inquiry having to do with the Chosen People festival culture, maybe?
Yes, the Holy Order of Beautiful People, which is a great theme or contrivance in your novel, and they are a chosen people, which is, that always gives me a sketchy alert, chosen people alert, no, and the reason I do want to toss it back to you is that, you know, to track, you know, the implications of that leads us really to Trump and the antagonism to immigrants and the us them, and as you know, one of your great characters who is part of the Holy Order of Beautiful People, Chris Bliss, is always describing, you know, the guru who's vanity plates are namaste, get him, Tony, I love that, is saying, you know, we're under threat. And tyranny does require an addiction to having an enemy, you know. And so I like the idea of throwing, you know, the addiction to having an enemy into the cauldron too, just blah, 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 blah. So the second part, I guess, was, you know, are you up for throwing chosen, the delusion of chosen people into the cauldron?
Oh, yes. I mean, by all means, where should I start with this? There's so many various directions to approach it from. I mean, I guess the main point I was hoping to sort of underline in my book with, you know, creating a cult called the Holy Company of Beautiful People, right, was that even though I might locate myself and to some extent even identify with, you know, maybe this sort of the left side of the political spectrum and the more, you know, visionary side of spirituality, all of this, right, I think it's important for people to realize that we're still human beings and we're still subject to the same mass delusions, right, that have infected the human psyche throughout all of history, right? And so myself, I've practiced yoga for better than 2 decades, right? And so I have plenty of experience in yoga and yogic communities, right? And I see the same, the creation of the same sort of structures that would impose themselves on the individual rather than liberating the individual. I think it's particularly ironic with yoga, right? Because, if you go to a yoga class, I'm sure many of your listeners have found themselves at one point or another in a yoga class sort of struggling to keep up, right? Or feeling like the instructor is going too fast or maybe have even injured themselves in the course of a yoga class, right? Which is, of course, exactly the opposite purpose of any sort of yogic exercise or meditation, right? The whole point is to feel your own body, right? Like, you're not supposed to be trying to keep up with some external and coercive structure, right? You're supposed to be dropping in with, your own nervous system, right? And feeling where your own imbalances may lie. I think the best that a yoga instructor could do is to sort of provide the skeletal framework, right, for the basic structure for the flow and for the practice, but to also encourage their students to diverge as they will, right, from this skeletal framework, right, and to drop in more deeply with their own intuition, right. But that, I think that's the fundamental struggle that humans have throughout history, is how do we create structures which we need, which we rely on, which simplify, our ability to process tremendous amounts of information. How do we create structures without then becoming slaves to those very structures, right? And it doesn't take anything more than the creation of a concept, any concept at all, and we've already created a structure. And then we begin to mistake that concept for the reality that it was intended to represent in the first place, right? And so visionary philosophers like Muhammad and Jesus and Buddha, right, their philosophy very quickly becomes ossified, sort of turned into stone. What was once a source of tremendous light and enlightenment for its followers becomes modern-day religion, becomes this stale sort of monolith that's devoid of any real life. Does that address your question?
Sure. And again, we have a shared love of etymology as intrinsically liberating, meaning tracking everything back, including words, to its originating impulse, and then kind of offering ourselves to that. So, yeah, it's medium recently that I understood orthodox, because ortho means straight, and dox is teaching. So straight teaching, and we go, no, we like our teaching curvy. Thank you very much. And so the hoodwinking of liberating teaching into state servitude or image servitude, or I love your analogy. Yoga is a great thing. I'm a yoga recidivist, but I intend to return, because it is really wonderful and genius. But there is the, as you say, the celebrity image quality. And I was in a class with a really great yoga teacher, all praise to Judith Lassiter, and a couple of people at the front of the class were voguing, were going, look at me, and she's like, no, I won't have that in my class. You go to the rear of the room, please. We go, right, because it's again that, I mean, John Berger he's now a late great ancestor. He was a wonderful kind of left-wing Marxist art critic. And in his great essay on the nude in art, in Ways of Seeing, he does a brilliant thing. I'll make it short. But he says, before industrialism, we have naked people cavorting, right? And here's your wonderful novel, Nine Kinds of Naked. Naked people cavorting, here they are, la la la, la 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 la. And then he says, once we have industrialism, for the first time ever in the history of art, we have the nude. And it's almost always a woman, and she's looking directly out of the painting, watching the viewer watch her. And he says this is a mean trick of, you know, my language, of the reality police to imprison, to engage people in complicity in their own imprisonment, that they become nude rather than naked, that whatever they're doing, they're watching themselves do it, and therefore they are no longer intimate with themselves, right? So I find that really useful, just again to put in our category, what's the con and what's the liberating trick? So, you know, nude would be the con, naked, authentic, la 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 would be the liberating trick. And you do a lot with this with your beautiful love stories in Nine Kinds of Naked, but also in Love and Other Pranks, which is an inspiring, I feel more hopeful about love. I mean, reading the book, and I think that's also part of your medicine, which is really fabulous to be insightful and spicy and satiric, but never jaded, because you come back to love is the liberating prank, right?
Exactly right. I think I can't quite remember how I said it in the book, but the scene that I was I kept coming back to was that love is a prank played on the ego by the spirit to teach the ego the one lesson that it tries throughout its life never to learn. And that lesson is that it's not in control, right? And when we love another, right, we discover very quickly that we aren't in control of the course of our lives, and that as love progresses, like, the well-being of another person becomes more important than the well-being of the ego, right? And so this is why I call love the universal solvent, right? It's the only force in the universe capable of dissolving the walls that the egoic structures of mind have imprisoned us within.
Yeah, and I would encourage our fabulous and dedicated listeners, some for 22 years and some for about a minute, to go to your website, tonyvigorito.com, because I was perusing some of your essays which are there, which are also fabulous, and I got through a couple. I'm going back to read them all, but you get to the etymology of the word yes, which derives from the same root as to be, and it's part of your essay on how you decided to say yes to many things that were not life-threatening. There's a wonderful photo of a couple. It's very like you. It's very like your novel. It's very like your life. There's a wonderful photograph of a couple dancing in the ruins of Lebanon. And the caption underneath the photo is, in spite of everything, yes. You know, and then... You do mention in your essay that, yeah, it is Molly Bloom's soliloquy. There's a great version read by Siobhan McKenna in James Joyce's Ulysses. You know, yes, I said yes, I will, yes. So yes, and that's a plucky, you know, your characters, your love story too, intertwining throughout time, the great pirates, and as my brother Joe said, he really gets pirates right, and maybe we can come back to that. But they are, you know, they are critical, insightful, they are oppressed, you know, they do wonderful liberating pranks, they expose cons, really good, comeuppance, satisfying. But they are always saying yes. They're saying yes to each other and yes to love and yes to the adventure. And I love your character, Flaming Jane, says, irony is a force in the world, and this will ensure our good fortune. That I just want to put that on my bathroom mirror. That's really good. So, yeah, really great. And then also you do get the con of the toxic mimic of the authentic, the toxic mimic of spiritual groups, the holy order of beautiful people, really just right. And you know, and with the vanity plate, namaste, you know, and that's, or I'm like, oh, go Tony, get him, that's really great. Yeah, the hoovering, the hoovering up of a kind of spiritually magnetic allures, you know, as a con to ensnare people, and could we say, you know, get them to outsource their autonomy to another person, and maybe that's a great theme in your love story, Love and Other Pranks, and also Nine Kinds of Naked, is that you are animating a love story in which really, through all the tussle and interesting arguments and a great parrot and everything, they are admiring and encouraging each other's autonomy throughout the whole thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And to your earlier point as well, a line that I have in the novel at one point is that the truth becomes false when spoken by a liar, right? And what I was trying to capture there was that the truth and falsity, they don't lie in the words themselves, they lie in the intention that is breathed into those words, right? And so it's fully possible for a malevolent personality to say all the right things, right? And to use all the right words, right? And yet to still be, you know, these words that we would assume are evocations of some higher truth, and yet that person is still lying, right? The person is still, and they're lying in that they're misrepresenting who they are. They're misrepresenting their intentions. They're misrepresenting their truth. And that happens in Baptist churches, you know, in the Deep South, just as much as it happens in yoga schools in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, yes, good themes. It's anything that's anywhere is everywhere. That's why, again, you know, it's a work of fiction that you're animating very useful guiding principles of discerning that, you know, in right wing, in left wing, and, you know, it's anywhere. And it's maybe our team of, you know, dedicated progressives that we identify with who are vulnerable to being snookered. It's one of the themes that we play with, which is just cause you take many entheogens does not necessarily, alas, make you more discerning or anything necessarily. And we go, oh, phooey. I know people who've taken many entheogens who are all up for Pizzagate. And then we go, no. I've been to that place, and the comet sign is a wonderful thing that's been just, you know, or people who would finger wag and go, if you don't think that the massacre of children in Connecticut was a false flag, then you're just being stuck. It's like, no, team, no discernment. There is, you know, and it discredits, you know, authentic deep delving, that there are conspiracies. I mean, that there are things worthy of it. And that's why, again, you know, we want to put these standards there. You know, is somebody deriving status from this thing? You know, and, standards of discernment. And I guess, you know, part of, you know, years ago, a great friend of mine, Josh Barron, was running a group in Berkeley called Sorting It Out for people leaving anything, any spiritual group, the Catholic Church, Synanon, Steve Gaskin's Farm, Muktananda, Rajneesh. So we did have the dirt on everybody. But there was a remarkable similarity. Once people outsourced their autonomy, all kinds of sketchy things could happen. But there's a beautiful thing that we can begin now and then animate further after the break. But you do a wonderful thing because you know, even spiritual groups led by creepy cons can have liberating merit, right? And you do a great animation of this in which, you know, a woman who's onto the con, but she does nonetheless experience a great healing, right? And I think that's an important point. I mean, is there anything you want to say, you know, briefly now and then more after the break about this idea that even the con can have its merit? Does it require?
Sure. There's, I can't remember. There's a saying I picked up somewhere that said a true seeker will find truth even if they're following a jackass. Right.
That's good.
In other words, it's the journey of seeking that is its own reward. You know, there's the place that you know the truth that you find and the place that you end up has very little to do with whatever gurus or would-be teachers had presented themselves along your path, and it has everything to do with your own commitment to discovering your truth. Right?
I mean, yes.
Just to return to the metaphor I was trying to develop around yoga is that I think that's what we're all seeking. That's what any student of yoga is seeking, is that deep sort of attunement with their own body. And the reason, and what their own body represents, is their nervous system. Your nervous system is distributed throughout, you know, the furthest extremities of your body. And so by stretching your body, you relax your nervous system, and you find the capacity to drop in with your own deepest truth, right?
Hold that thought, because we're going to take a very short musical break, Taj Mahal, from usual, and we'll be right back with Tony Vigorito, and we'll be exploring, again, the sketchy versus the authentic, and how we can feel the difference with his wonderful, wonderful novel, Love and Other Pranks, and we'll be right back after this very short break.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Off and down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Ooh, chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, on the 22nd anniversary of the Visionary Activist Show this first Thursday in September. And so more than perfectly hosting a wonderful ally, colleague, Tony Vigorito, and his fantastic novel. Really, everybody get 5 copies, called Love and Other Pranks. It's true. I gave one to my brother. I finished reading it myself. I want to give it to many other people. And Tony's website is tonyvigorito.com, full of great essays and wit and discernment and spiciness and a sharp intellect and satiric mind wedded to a kind heart. It's the best thing. So where we were is, again, discerning, I guess, the sketchy from the authentic, right? And that's something that we can feel, right?
Sure. And I can't quite remember where we were in our discussion, but
I had to cut you off for the break music, but you were about, you know, yoga is an authentic and beautiful thing in our body and the nervous system. I'm like, yes, I must do that in stretching. And then, you know, that is authentic. And then, you know, anything can become an imagey thing. I think that's where we were, you know, spiraling back
to
that.
Sure, thing. Right. And I think it was just sort of an encouragement for people to listen to themselves, right? To listen to their own bodies and allow any teacher to sort of be like a distant echo that is perhaps, you know, encouraging suggestions that might point them in the right direction, but also might confuse them, further. But I'm deeply chaotic and, as you say, trickster in my nature, which to me means sort of just a mistrust, almost an instinctive mistrust of any external source of authority. I mean, this traces its way all the way back to ancient Greek philosophy with the ancient Cynics, right, who, in contrast to what cynicism means in the modern world, right, in ancient Greek philosophy, to be a cynic meant that you were mistrustful of other people's motives, but mainly because those motives, they were being motivated by the desire for money, power, sex, or prestige, or something like this, right? And so to the extent that, you know, people are being motivated in that direction, I think we do need to be very discerning, right, in terms of their source of authority. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. Right. No, absolutely. And again, just speaking in praise of intellect and discernment as very happy companions with the heart. Right. So, you know, I think we all want to be dedicated to not being snookered into a false polarity, or really any polarity in a way, you know, meaning spiraling out of it, willing to liberate. So deeply chaotic, instinctive mistrust of any external authority is what you just said. We go, yes, we are with you. And so we might also, I like throwing everything into the cauldron as you do in a great, fictional form, Love and Other Pranks. Which is, I think it's a great idea to throw everything into the bubbling cauldron now, all spiritual teachings. It will only do everything good, you know, to go, does it guide people to their own autonomy? You know, is it equal, Mars and Venus, men and women? Is it equal in its considering of humans and the rest of our companions on this earth? Is the trickster welcome? Can the truth be said without cringing? Is disruption okay? You know, and we go, yes, we ladle it out. No, we throw it back in for another round of bubbling there. Just, you know, a simple guideline clarifying, you know, if one feels cringy, like, ooh, you know, in a group, then it's like, no, maybe it's time to skedaddle. And that idea of skedaddling and leaving the gate open. You know, I was telling my trickster council last night that, you know, when I started off a million years ago as a little beginning metaphysician, astrologer, I hurtled myself into London, my attitude was anyone who said they had, you know, ancient teachings or whatever, I'm like, sure. Yeah, I got the occult esoteric guide to London and checked out every authentic and sketchy and, you know, weird thing possible and then learned a lot going, good. It is a good part of people that gets them involved in spiritual groups because it is great to have a community. And things do happen when you're practicing with others. But then it can start to get sketchy with the, you know, when there's one person and then they're surrounded by true believers and then they begin to mess with your, you know, autonomy or your sex life. And it's like it's almost too late, but it's definitely time to go. So, you know, in your research, you know, I mean, have you had experience with Holy Order of Beautiful People like things?
Excellent question. I mean, you know, right after I moved to Austin, Texas in 2007, right, I, just as the flow of my life would have it, I happened to meet a number of people that were just sort of stumbling, shell-shocked out of a local cult that had just imploded down in Austin, Texas at the time, right? And as I myself was just kind of stepping out of the implosion of a marriage, right? Psychologically, we had a lot in common in that, like, the structures of our mind that had sort of told us who we were and what the path of our life was all about had just been, you know, completely devastated beyond repair, right? And so I became fast friends with a number of these people, and this was a cult that was some 200 people strong. I got to know at a pretty deep level at least a dozen of them, and they would tell me these stories, and I would just, you know, again, both as a social psychologist and as a novelist, I would just sit in rapt attention, just like I couldn't even believe what I was hearing. You literally can't make this stuff up. If you were to tell someone this story, they would think you were exaggerating, right? And so that sort of inspired my interest in researching cults. So I read a handful of books on the topic and did the relevant sort of social psychological research into it to really understand all of the dynamics that sort of propel those. And for me, the cult became sort of shorthand for a culture, right? Obviously, they derive from the same root, right? And all the same dynamics by which a person abdicates their autonomy in a cult are also happening at a less obvious level when an individual participates in a culture, right? And I think the solution to that sort of dynamic is really just mindfulness, like being mindful that you're always making a decision, right? Even when you're not aware that you're making a decision, you're making a decision, even if that's a decision that's being compelled by the culture or the cult that you are participating in, right? So in any event, it was sort of a delight to find out that last year a documentary had been recently completed about this cult in Austin, Texas, and it premiered at the Sundance Film Festival last year. The name of the documentary was Holy Hell. It was directed by one of the people I had met in my early years in Austin, Texas, and it did quite well. It was very well reviewed by critics. It may even be streaming on various platforms for all I know right now. But in any event, that cult was sort of the beginning of the Holy Company of Beautiful People. And then, of course, I researched a dozen different other cults, up to and including Charles Manson's cult in the late 1960s, right, and incorporated, you know, various bizarre elements of cultic practices into my own story.
Yeah, no, I've been researching and living cults. I like your identification, you know, that a bad marriage can be like a cult or even a mini inquisition, right? Because it's where one doesn't see oneself. It's like I don't see myself here. I don't know. I've read about cults. I've been in cults, right? As a young person stepping out, going, yes, go to India with Guru. Oh, his Mahatmas stormed the Times of India building and killed a guard. Wait a minute here. Okay, time to back out. You know, and people who we can see what keeps people past the expiration date, you know, going, yes, it's true, but I just want to stay for the sacred knowledge and I'll be out soon enough, you know, and sometimes the door closes. I have friends and astro clients who are survivors of Jonestown. And by the way, they really, really, I join them in really, really, let's throw the metaphor of, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid into the cauldron. They find it offensive. It wasn't Kool-Aid. And also we just, you know, it's because that's a sneaky, condescending thing. I didn't drink the Kool-Aid. And it's like, no, but you might have. I mean, to understand, you know, that it is good parts of people that get them involved. I mean, Jim Jones was an extraordinary, you know, because it was a progressive, you know, multicultural, embracing, positive thing that got people involved and a utopian desire. But then that's why we want to notice the warning signs, you know, when one person with aviator glasses are a problem often, not always, but often, you know, and we don't really know somebody till we've seen them in control. We go, oh, that can happen. And the reason I find our dedication and your work and your beautiful book, Love and Other Pranks, I want to keep touting it because I really do ardently love it. So pertinent is we're all in a cult right now. We're in a Trump cult, right? And how did this happen? And there are, you know, there's a lot. I have yet to read Herman Melville's apparently great novel called The Con Man, which is sort of essence of America, because America is very confused about the difference between the con man and the trickster. We kind of root for the con, but maybe this Trumpian diabolic experience will heal people about that. But You know, but the idea that this country is founded on fantasy, and there's a great book coming out, Kurt Eichenwald, who wrote a book called Fantasyland, right? 500 years of American kind of delusion, and only in Fantasyland can Trump be president. I'm eager to go read that too. I think to understand, you know, loving words, illusion comes from in ludo, in the game, delusion, de ludo, out of the game. So we do, we like illusion, metaphors for reality, shape-shifting, fabulous things, you know, and then a delusion, you know, out of the game is, you know, again, where somebody's hoovering our autonomy, and that's what we, you know, and I just want to encourage all of our team to tease in the discerning way, going, you know, if this is true, you know, or if we go this way, where does it lead to, right? And that's why, you know, there's so many sneaky forms of spiritual colonialism. That's why I come back to the chosen people. We are, you know, part of the 144 ascended masters who, whatever the thing is, or we are great, but those people are reptiles. And I go, no. But I think our attitude, and let me toss this to you too, is, you know, we need everybody. We want everybody in a, you know, all hands on deck. So it's like, you know, when people show up going, I am one of the great, you know, 144 ascended masters and the most beloved of who's a, we go, oh, come on aboard, regardless of your weird inflationary self-mythologizing. We need you too. I mean, do you feel like you're extending an invitational, like, come on, everybody, you know, and leave your delusional costume, but here's a more fun costume.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's just, I want to see everybody, I just want to see everyone be themselves, right? And, you know, to, you know, in the microcosm of a cult, right? I mean, you know, people oftentimes will ask, like, why did that person stay in that cult, mm-hmm. right? And there's a lack of understanding of what drives human psychology, you know, and what benefits a person is gaining from participation in a community. I mean, first of all, I think the number one thing that leaves us uniquely vulnerable to cults is a complete lack of community. In most segments of American society, right? It's a very isolated, very alienated sort of structure that we are sort of channeled into as we move into our adulthood. And so then when a person like stumbles into a community, right? Then this is something that they've been searching for, whether or not they're aware of it, right, for years, right? And that community is going to provide them with a tremendous amount of material and non-material resources. We're not just talking about money. We're also talking about, you know, a shoulder to lean on when you're having a difficult time, someone to listen to you, you know, someone to bounce ideas off of, someone to counsel, so on and so forth, right? And so as a person gets drawn into any community, right, they develop an identity. And that identity is not who they are, it's where they are, right? Identity is social location. It's how we locate ourselves in reference to the social world. That's the first thing to realize. And then the second part of that is this, that identity is not only social location, but it's based on access to resources, right? And so when a community is providing you with material and non-material resources, you become, right, that you become an expression of that community, and that community begins to dictate your identity, right? Which can be a good thing, but it can also be a dangerous thing. Is it any accident, right, that patriarchy disallowed women from keeping their own paychecks until something like 100 years ago, right? I mean, even after women were allowed to work, they weren't able to keep their own resources, right? In other words, then their husband was, or their father was, still in charge of their resources. Now, if identity is based on access to resources, right, that gave men this unprecedented level of control over the identity, the social location of women, right? And this very subtle form of psychological enslavement that, you know, crept upon, you know, 55% of the human population as patriarchy proceeded, right? But we see that happening at the macro, at the cosmic scale, and we see it happening at the microcosmic scale. Why does woman stay in an abusive relationship, right? Because identity is social location, and social location is based on access to resources, right? There's some material or non-material, this could be an emotional resource, right, that partner is somehow dependent upon. It's no accident that cults, as they progress, will increasingly seek to control its members' access to resources. There's a restaurant in San Diego I won't name, but it's run by a cult, and none of the workers there are paid, right? Mm. They're given free room and board, right? But they're not paid for their labor, because if they were paid for their labor, that would give them the opportunity to choose against staying within that social structure.
Right. No, this is very important. So we might have the con is the cult, and the antidote is team. You know, I was doing astrological consulting for a woman who was in a terrible, violent, dangerous marriage, right, and couldn't leave for all of the reasons we understand, you know. But I did say, I go, okay, you know, but the team of women in your similar circumstance is counting on you. And she just sat up straight and she goes, really? Really? The team of women in similar circumstances counting on me? All right, then. Went home, kicked butt, got a restraining order, got a divorce, kicked the guy, you know, rrr. And I think that's also part of, you know, it's like there's beautiful parts of us as well that will do more for others than we would do for ourselves. And to feel that sense of team, you know, and that is a lot of what people do want. Yeah, identity is social location and access to resources. Yeah, and that's why, you know, cults will isolate people. We are enlightened, but other people are not. You must not communicate with your family or other people because they are not enlightened anymore. And by the way, you know, give us your whole paycheck, and you know exactly what you said, and or you eat such a low protein diet, you know, and you have no money. It's very hard to leave the farm or what, you know, whatever the thing is. We go, uh-oh. So yeah, so having a team, you know, and us, all of us, extending our intimate embrace, going, we're all, you know, ever more effective players on the team of creation, may it be, you know, and everybody's got a unique gift to contribute, and that's also a distinction I like to make, which is special, see, is kind of a celebrity thing that makes people passive, but unique, everyone cultivating their uniqueness is liberating and encouraging to everybody to cultivate their uniqueness. So I like making that distinction, too. You have some great wordplay. You know, my copy of Love and Other Pranks is full of index cards and circles and underlining things. It looks like an animated hedgehog. It's alive. It's alive. But I love, you know, just even early on, you know, on page 21, you say, if hedonism had hired mysticism as its decorator, we go, that's very fun. That's really great. But can I read you two of your beautiful sentences, or actually the beautiful paragraph towards the end? Is that okay with you? That I have underlined here.
No, please.
Yeah. Well, it's as the cult is the con is becoming apparent, and it's busted due to our protagonist's liberating theater, and. And you write, you know, about the people going, oh, what do we do now? Who are we? You know, lost in the wilds, you write, of life and sadness, alas, yet out of this suffering was born an epiphany for some, an epiphany decades in its discovery, the despondent understanding that they were alone, and the heartrending realization that they were nobody special after all, that they were just a lost soul feeling its way through life, and that although everybody dies alone, that not everybody dies lonely, and there's therefore no greater service than to comfort another soul, to make another life easier, to soothe another solitude, to serve another oneself, and to love as large as life allows and even more. That's just beautiful, beautiful writing, Tony Vigorito. It's really great. And just distilling it down, and again, you do come back to that over and over again, so that's one of the many things I had underlined. You know, distilled and simple, but really clarifying. So that's great. So your view of we're in a Trumpian delusional cult, right? But as is clear in history, I suppose, and myth, and in your novels, cults do meet their demise. They do. The con man is, you know, his first con, right? So this con apparently seems to be deflating like a souffle. What do you think?
Nicely said. And I think people that people that are victimized by a con, they proceed with their lives with several degrees greater savvy, right? In terms of
yes,
understanding the forces of manipulation and taking greater responsibility for their decisions, right? So for me, I feel like the cutting edge of human consciousness is really mindfulness. The ability to understand our own psychologies. To see what's compelling us, to see the social forces that are driving us, and then to make mindful decisions about is that something I want to participate in, or is that something I want to withdraw my attention from entirely, right? And it may well be that, Trump is just I don't even have words to describe this fool. I mean, he's just sort of the demon or something, right, that is creating this sort of diffusion of enlightenment in his wake, right? I think
he's possessed by that demon. And we're on our way out all too soon, but I want to thank you forever for your work and keep apprising me of anything else I should know that you're up to. Tony Vigorito's novel, Love and Other Pranks, cannot recommend it highly enough. Tom Roberts said, maybe the single wildest novel I've ever read, which is true. It is absolutely true. And also, I was rereading just a little bit and have an even deeper appreciation of your crafted symmetry. You got very beautiful structure to this novel. It bears rereading as well. So thank you, Tony Vigorito.
Thank you, Caroline. Always a delight.
That's great. So TonyVigorito.com is Tony's website, full of essays and really great things. And we might say, let's keep adding, our autonomous genius muse, which always discerns the authentic and hops up and down to inform us. And we turn on our internal bogus alert app and our enthusometer when we encounter that which makes our heart dance, that is authentic. That's wonderful. So thanks always to Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. I'm Caroline Casey. Follow me on Twitter, Stand Up Coyote, or CoyoteNetworkNews.com. Or Facebook, Coyote Network News, and we will reconvene next week. Thank you all so much. Woof, woof, woof.
This is Dennis Bernstein from the Flashpoints team. Are you singing the blues about corporate news? Are you interested in the news behind the censored news? Then your ticket to the truth is Flashpoints, the electronic canary in the coal mine of corporate disinformation. Tune in to Flashpoints every weekday at 5 p.m. on KPFA listener-sponsored radio for the Bay Area and beyond. Thank you.
The cost of independence is responsibility. KPFA's mission is to speak the truth to power and extend our platform to voices that never get heard in the mass media noise. Help keep us vigilant. You can donate online at any time at kpfa.org or during our fall fund drive. The cost of independence may be high, yet never so high as the loss of it. Thank you for your generous support.
You're listening to KPFA 94.1, KPFB 89.3 in Berkeley, and KFCF 88.1 in Fresno.
KPFA, KPFB, in Berkeley, this Bobby,